The Mysteries of Watergate, Episode 32, A Lid on Liddy.
I want to talk to you tonight from my heart on a subject of deep concern to every American.
Those who hate you don't win unless you hate them.
I've been charged with involvement.
A full, free, and absolute pardon unto Richard Nixon.
What has come to be known as the Watergate Affair.
Hello, I'm John O'Connor, author of Postgate, How the Washington Post Betrayed Deep Throat, Covered Up Watergate, and Began Today's Partisan Advocacy Journalism. Gordon Liddy is one of Watergate's most fascinating characters in a scandal featuring many intriguing actors. A man who had a martial view of life and admirer of the Teutonic sense of honor displayed by Adolf Hitler and his regime, Liddy, in his own way, was very moral. He cared deeply about the success of the Nixon administration and the welfare of the American people. Unfortunately for Liddy, he fell under the sway of two men who did not have the best interests at heart of Nixon or of Liddy himself. And a third actor, James McCord, who was thrust upon him, was anything but straight with Liddy. As we noted earlier, even though Liddy had been in a unique position of interacting with these men, as well as every other key player in Watergate, often in the role of a dupe, out of a sense of honor, he did not share his knowledge publicly when the public most needed his knowledge. Liddy waited for all statutes of limitation to expire before writing his candid memoir, Will, in 1980. We talked in our last episode about how the CIA documents and testimony summarized by the Baker Report comprised a test of the honesty of the Post reporting. Liddy's book in 1980, as the writing on the scandal is becoming history, not news, and with no present political impact, presented an even more profound test of the Post history-making truthfulness. After all, in the heat of the partisan moment, as Nixon was rocked back on his heels, it was understandable, albeit not excusable, that the Post pulled its punches so reprehensibly during the scandal. But by 1980, Nixon was solidly disgraced, a Democrat Jimmy Carter was in office, and the Post was, with the past help of Deep Throat, solidly established alongside the New York Times as America's leading news sources. So if Liddy offered new insights, which altered the public's perception of Watergate, the Post could offer them to America without admitting any past deception, and in doing so, it could cause our history to be written with at least a dose of even-handedness. On the other hand, 6 years after the scandal's conclusion, if the Post were to distort Liddy's revelations, it would now be deliberately falsifying our country's history. Because the Post, especially through Bob Woodward, was considered to be the repository of all Watergate wisdom, and because the Post had withheld so much from the public during the scandal, its deceit, ironically, meant that the public did not know what it did not know, so it would depend on the Post and Woodward to explain Liddy. So what, if anything, did Liddy write that was significantly fresh, and how did the Post handle it? As it turned out, perhaps not surprisingly, Woodward reviewed this book with alacrity. Why would the managing editor of the Post, Woodward's exalted celebrity position, stoop to write what purported to be a full review as opposed to simply commenting on it? Why not a television interview or simply an op-ed? The answer is obvious. A full-on review would be definitive, could not be easily challenged, and in any case would suck up all the oxygen in the Liddy room. Few would dare contradict Woodward on Watergate. In his book, Liddy told the theretofore untold story of how he came to work for the CRP, transferring from the White House Plumbers Unit. The story is intriguing, but only if put in context by a knowledgeable observer. In the fall of 1971, it had become clear that there would be a need for a skilled lawyer to handle campaign contributions with the upcoming advent of a new disclosure law to take effect on April 7, 1972. The CRP, presumably under Mitchell's direction, tried to recruit Dean's highly respected associate White House counsel, Fred Fielding. Dean had two big problems with this. First, he would thereby lose his valuable right-hand man, Fielding, far more capable a lawyer than Dean. Secondly, Fielding was not suited to the illegal hijinks necessary for a shadowy intelligence dirt-gathering project. Accordingly, he discouraged Fielding from leaving the White House. At the same time, according to Liddy, Dean actively recruited him to the new position, refraining from any focus on campaign finance. Instead, Dean sold Liddy on a dirt-gathering campaign, promising him a budget at least, quote, $500,000 for openers, unquote. In Will, Liddy told the readers that this is what sold him on a job that otherwise would be dead end. Of course, Liddy eagerly accepted. Parenthetically, given his close and adoring friendship with dashing spy Hunt, who cleverly cultivated him, his head was likely already full of cloak and dagger dreams. What is so significant about Dean's recruitment of Liddy? Well, to get a bit ahead of ourselves, months later, in the two meetings in which Dean and Magruder accompanied Liddy to make a presentation to Attorney General John Mitchell about the proposed intelligent program, that is, the Gemstone Intelligence Program, Mitchell clearly was not buying it. Mitchell's disdain was so apparent in the second meeting on February 4, 1972, that Dean interrupted Liddy, saying this was not an appropriate subject to be discussed in the Attorney General's office. After the second meeting, as well as after the first, Dean and Magruder advised Liddy that Mitchell was simply not buying the price tag, $1 million for the first proposal, $500,000 for the second. But again, so what? An astute observer, as Woodward was, would have known that Mitchell never had an appetite for skullduggery. As Magruder would later claim, when he testified that Mitchell suggested breaking into the DNC, and that would be in a March 30, 1972 meeting. Interestingly enough, almost 2 months after the February 4 debacle in which an embarrassed Liddy left the room after Dean's comment. For his part, Dean, in later testimony, insisted after he heard Liddy's second presentation that he immediately marched into Haldeman's office to say he was disgusted with Liddy's antics and would have no further involvement. Haldeman, a scrupulous and habitual note-taker, had no record of any such conversations with Dean anywhere near that time and had no memory of any such statements by Dean. So with Liddy's candid account, we must credit Haldeman's version, and we must also conclude that Mitchell never had a desire for any breaking or eavesdropping at any time, anywhere, as Mitchell testified. Yet Dean had recruited Liddy, which Liddy presumed had authority from Mitchell, asserting his, that's Dean's authority, to Liddy specifically for an expensive intelligence operation. Thus, Liddy's book is an interesting insight into how Watergate began. So Liddy's book strongly supports Mitchell's testimony and throws Magruder's into serious doubt. Even more significantly, it tends to finger Dean as the culprit, the moving force behind the Watergate break-ins. Woodward also had learned of Tony Ulasewicz's claim, that's the White House detective that was kept under wraps under John Caulfield. Ulasewicz's claim that Dean had asked him to, quote, case, unquote, the DNC in late fall 1971 after having Ulasewicz look into the Happy Hooker prostitute ring in New York in the fall of 1971. So putting this together logically, we now have two conclusions from this book. First, Mitchell did not authorize the break-ins, and of course, neither did the Oval Office. And second, Dean was their father, and not for campaign purposes, but for his own, quote, blind ambition, unquote, dirt gathering, seeking to elevate his stature. If this is so, how can the burglary be pinned on Nixon's inner circle, which never included Dean, a minion Nixon had never met? We know now, of course, that Nixon was covering up for, he thought, Mitchell or Colson, and the cover-up was directed by Dean, without his disclosure, of who was really responsible, that is, this young White House counsel himself. So Liddy's book gave Woodward all he needed for a sensational addendum to the Post reporting on Watergate, one in which the Post need not have admitted its prior guilt in covering up Watergate. Now let us look at how Liddy's book affected the CIA. Liddy gives great detail about the massive agency-wide assistance given to all of the operations of the plumbers, for example, in the Ellsberg burglary and later in the Watergate burglary. Cameras, safe houses, CIA aliases, the whole works. Unbeknownst until his book, Liddy recounts the professional charts prepared by the CIA graphics department for his first Gemstone presentation. This is especially significant for the theories we propound in this series. It means from our remove that the CIA deliberately put its own imprint on the operation so that later it could claim presidential approval for the CIA to do what it was doing. Those charts should later incriminate the CIA to some degree, but that was not the purpose at the time they presented these charts. In these charts, Liddy described in detail the highly sophisticated, indeed fevered, operations he first proposed up to the ludicrous point of chase planes to electronically eavesdrop on other planes that the chase plane was to chase. There were other highly involved operations proposed, such as kidnapping protesters, hiring prostitutes as spies, and the like. We ask, did any of these ideas come from Hunt? The book does not say, but Liddy admits, indeed boasts happily, about his close friendship with Hunt. These proposed operations could later be used to whitewash any agency illegality if it was later caught performing any of these operations. So Hunt's fingerprints appear to be all over Liddy's first chart, if not the second proposal. But more importantly, so do Mullins. It was Mullins, through Bennett, and Hunt, who first suggested psychologically profiling Ellsberg and later the need for his psychiatric records, which in turn required a burglary. In addition, Liddy adds a capper. Robert Bennett, president of Mullen, directly suggested a burglary and safe-cracking of the safe of Las Vegas Sun publisher Hank Greenspun, which would yield documents which would show that they would, quote, blow Muskie out of the water, unquote. Bennett suggested coordination with the aides of secretive billionaire Howard Hughes. After Hunt and Liddy suggested to use the need for a private getaway jet, the Hughes organization withdrew. Let's stop here. First, Bennett's active involvement, not news to our podcast audience, would have been new to the public and would once again suggest CIA covert operations. But even more probative was the Hughes angle, since any Washington insider knew of Hughes' tie-up with the CIA. The abortive Greenspun burglary project, along with the Ellsberg Fielding burglary, would strongly corroborate Mullen as a cover company for Hunt and the CIA, and would be quite consistent with Mullen and Hunt being the fathers behind the CIA's involvement in the Watergate burglary. Dean, of course, having his own careerist ambitions from which the CIA took great advantage. Now, a small but telling anecdote inculpating a prostitute information target. Liddy notes that on June 12, as Magruder was ordering a second burglary, he forcefully slammed his open hand on the lower left desk drawer, saying, "We want to know what they have in here." He did not mention Larry O'Brien, but Liddy inferred an O'Brien target, giving his prior belief that McCord would insert an O'Brien room bug in the first burglary, of course, which was not true. The point here is that the main target was documents. Because Liddy mistakenly believed that there was a prior room bug put in O'Brien's office, fixing that bug was a secondary task wished by Liddy. Remember, McCord had given the excuse that the first bug was shielded by concrete and steel. Of course, there was no room bug. So let's stop here. We know that cameras were being set up during the burglary, and Martinez was caught with the Maxie Wells key. So Liddy's book would have given Woodward and the Post a face-saving way of putting this all together and showing the salacious information that the second burglary was truly about. But there is more. Liddy wrote that he thought the first burglary was about surveilling O'Brien's office, but Woodward knew of McCord's testimony before the Irvin Committee, even if it escaped Liddy. McCord had testified that the burglars did not even enter O'Brien's office during the first burglary. Recall also that McCord testified that the team did not even know where O'Brien's office was in preparation for the second burglary, therefore assigning Baldwin to do a DNC walkthrough during the week prior to the second burglary. And recall his rather weird testimony that the burglars in the first burglary had tapped O'Brien and his phone through a remote, quote, call director, unquote, line, going to O'Brien's office from an office phone near Oliver's office. So odd indeed if the target was really O'Brien. We do not believe that a call director was ever tapped, but if one was tapped, it might yield only orders for paperclips to O'Brien's secretaries. Who knows what was on that one call director line out of 15 or 20 going to O'Brien's area. Yet Liddy quite clearly relates his understanding that the first burglary was to penetrate O'Brien's office with at least a room bug, indeed a state-of-the-art, super-sophisticated $30,000 room bug implanted in furniture and espoused and hyped by McCord. McCord later told Liddy that the bug was shielded by concrete and steel and thus not providing a signal that could make it to the monitor. So these facts alone show that McCord had lied to Liddy about the true purpose of the first burglary and what had been done on the first burglary, and had lied to him about ever purchasing a $30,000 room bug. These lies, in turn, suggest, of course, a hidden CIA agenda in Watergate. It would therefore be easy, the proverbial piece of cake, to expose McCord's lies to Liddy simply by comparing McCord's sworn testimony to Liddy's book. Certainly there was a secret agenda, likely of the CIA, but certainly a secret agenda. Again, Woodward could, with verisimilitude, express shock and reported this story in his upcoming review and gained kudos for his candor and insight. But there is more that Liddy unintentionally reveals in his book, which Woodward praises justly as being candid. Woodward's false story to Liddy about buying the $30,000 room bug has multiple implications. McCord's false story to Liddy, again, shows that McCord was giving Liddy, as a White House and Nixon representative, a story that justified use of the campaign funds and therefore can be sold at least to Liddy and perhaps in the first burglary to Magruder himself. In fact, McCord's team did not have the least little interest in investigating O'Brien, and nothing happened with O'Brien. This is the key takeaway, if nothing else, from Liddy's book. You will hear the Post today say that this burglary was about O'Brien. This deceit also explains the photos developed after the first burglary from Rich's photo in Miami. These showed gloved hands displaying on a shag carpet, stationery emblazoned with the letterhead Director, Democratic National Committee. We now know that these were phony, staged photos of a, quote, trophy, unquote, entry to prove penetration of O'Brien's office. To be sure, some present-day commentators, now knowing that the DNC had no shag carpets, have surmised that the burglars took the documents from the DNC to the Howard Johnson. This makes no sense. Why photograph a document you already possess? The burglars were under this silly hypothesis, have the documents themselves, with no plans to return them. In other words, they possessed the documents themselves and didn't need photos to show penetration. Any needed copies could be Xeroxed, available technology in 1972, so they wouldn't need a picture. And if you have the documents, why the gloved hands? Those hands are only on there supposedly to avoid the fingerprints on documents which you have possessed during a burglary. In any case, this scenario only makes sense if the burglars were fooling their sponsors about the operation. Let me put it more simply. It is clear from Liddy's book that they never entered O'Brien's office in the first burglary, yet the Rich's photo shots were meant to show that they had entered O'Brien's office. But of course, there's a bigger deceit. Clearly, there was never the super-sensitive, super-sophisticated room bug which McCord had told Liddy he spent $30,000 to purchase. The cheap microphone they were installing on arrest was meant to send signals showing again an O'Brien office penetration and, quote, fix, unquote, of the allegedly shielded $30,000 room bug. When this bug presented a signal, presumably McCord could say that the super-sophisticated bug was fixed. But there is much more, as Woodward's group knew, but few others did. The $30,000 was partially spent on six bugs still on order with Michael Stevens, if you recall our Michael Stevens presentations. Three room bugs that could uplink to the CIA satellites, presumably the same with the three phone bugs also on order. Liddy's book also has another revelation, that McCord was continually slipping away before the burglary, and they didn't know where, consistent with meetings with Russell. McCord deceitfully delayed the ultimate entry by 45 minutes after there was a vacation of the office, which delay McCord caused, likely by waiting for Russell to return from Benedict, Maryland, where he had gone to establish his alibi because of the late hour. McCord's disappearances were so mysterious that Liddy compared McCord to the radio character Lamont Cranston, a.k.a. The Shadow. McCord also lied to the other burglars about removing the tape on the locks, remaining tape which allowed Russell's entrance. So Liddy's description of McCord's furtive, odd actions corroborate Russell's hidden involvement. Another oddity from Liddy's book. After the burglary of Fielding, the team told Liddy, we now know falsely, that they came up empty. But Liddy adds the otherwise hidden and head-scratching detail that the team celebrated that night with champagne on ice. So again, Liddy proves unwittingly that the CIA had sequestered the fruits of an operation, that is, the Fielding burglary, into which, like Watergate, it had inveigled the White House. And remember that the Watergate burglars had not been taping calls, again, to sequester the fruits from the White House. This is a key revelation that Woodward should have jumped upon. Liddy also describes a meeting with Hunt and a, quote, retired, unquote, CIA poisons doctor, Edward Gunn, to discuss ways of disabling columnist Jack Anderson. Liddy was unaware of the CIA's threatening stalking of Anderson at the time, that is, Operation Mudhand, and therefore did not know who was the, quote, principal, unquote, for whom Hunt spoke very elliptically. Again, the clueless Liddy is pointing, without realizing it, to the CIA through this meeting. So now let's get to Woodward's review. There was plenty for Woodward to show Dean's sponsorship to prove a CIA hidden agenda, to corroborate a salacious target, to implicate Mullen as a cover company, and to out McCord as a CIA agent, lying to Liddy and others. What did his widely ballyhooed review reveal of these sensational allegations? Well, he said that the book gave the best proof yet of CIA foreknowledge of Watergate. This was, hold on, the charts that the CIA printed for Liddy. We are serious about this. That is the best proof, according to Woodward. This, of course, is nothing burger evidence implicating a graphic artist, and is silly. It is, to mix up a metaphor, praising the agency with faint damn. Of course, by saying that this is the worst evidence yet about the CIA, he is intentionally concealing all of the evidence of McCord's hidden agenda and the widespread CIA support for the burglary team. Does he highlight any of the highly incriminating evidence we have here summarized? Not a word. Nothing. Then what else does Woodward write in what is supposed to be a thorough, definitive review of Liddy's book by the Watergate master? One anecdote Woodward relates but distorts is John Mitchell's dry, sarcastic response to Liddy's fatuous proposal to use organized crime thugs, known killers, to help carry out a kidnapping plot on delegates in Miami or protesters. Mitchell said, Gordon, let's not contribute any more than we need to organize crime coffers. To anyone reading Liddy's book, Mitchell is offering a dry put-down to the idea. To Woodward, this shows that Mitchell was willing to contribute to organized crime. We quote his review. Mitchell was willing as Attorney General to pay Nixon campaign funds to members of organized crime for their services in a scheme never carried out to kidnap, drug, or ship to Mexico radical demonstration leaders. Liddy quotes Mitchell as saying in response to the proposal, quote, let's not contribute any more than we have to the coffers of organized crime, unquote. Of course, to a reader ignorant of the context of Mitchell's witty put-down, the former attorney general would appear to be an evil man in league with organized crime. This part of Woodward's review is completely dishonest. There's no other way to put it. Woodward is also dishonest in his claim of Liddy's telling Mitchell of the planned second break-in. Quote from Woodward's review. Liddy says he delivered logs of wiretapped conversations to Mitchell 2 days before the Watergate arrests and told him of the planned break-in by announcing that the problem, brackets, with one of the microphones, bracket, will be corrected this weekend, sir, end of quote within a quote. Mitchell has repeatedly denied he knew of the June 17 break-in in advance. Liddy offers convincing evidence to the contrary. I cannot tell you how directly dishonest this treatment is. Note that the words, quote, with the microphone, are in brackets. So Woodward, by inserting the bracketed words, completely changed the meaning of what Liddy actually said to Mitchell, which in its non-bracketed form was opaque and meant by Liddy, who assumed Mitchell knew of what he spoke, to be careful not to inform others in the meeting of what he was speaking. Almost comically, Mitchell, unbeknownst to Liddy, was completely uninformed about the meaning of the remark and certainly of any burglary, but Woodward falsely says otherwise. And you note that Woodward talks about delivery of the wiretapped conversations to Mitchell. There is nothing from the write-up of the wiretapped conversations that would give the reader the knowledge that they were from wiretaps. In fact, they are written specifically not to give that impression. Of course, it is not clear that Mitchell ever even read the envelope. So here, Woodward inculpates Mitchell when he should be exculpating him. Now, there's no doubt that Liddy thought that the purpose of the second burglary was to find out derogatory information which the Democrats had on the Republicans, but did think they would be in O'Brien's desk. However, Magruder never told Liddy that it was O'Brien that was the target, and Woodward omits the notion that Magruder never said that O'Brien was the target of this derogatory information. We know now it was the desk of Maxie Wells. Woodward then writes about two illegal operations, or ostensibly illegal operations, as to which Liddy provides details. Now, let me quote from Woodward's account of two operations, that is, the discussions about disabling or assassinating Jack Anderson and also the Ellsberg burglary. Quote, so when he gets down to the accounts of the crucial meetings, planning sessions, and the actual illegal operations themselves, the Watergate break-in of June 17, 1972, or the entry at the office of the psychiatrist of Pentagon's Papers defendant Daniel Ellsberg, or the planned assassination of columnist Jack Anderson, Liddy is meticulous. His story rings true, and balanced against the other evidence and testimony of the many Watergate investigations, it is credible. Yes, it is clear that Liddy is credible in the details, but what Woodward omits is the plentiful evidence that these operations point to the CIA, not to the White House. Planned assassination of Jack Anderson of the disabling clearly is part of Operation Mudhand of the CIA. The Ellsberg break-in was clearly suggested by Mullen and the CIA psychiatric folks, and it is clear that those fruits were sequestered. Philip DiDiego says that he actually helped copy the psychiatric records, and yet they never went to the White House. So yes, these details ring true, but if Woodward brought the other evidence to bear, Liddy's recounting would show CIA involvement, as we have discussed earlier. Woodward says just the opposite here. Woodward knew of Operation Mudhen, the CIA's threatening stalking of Anderson. At the same time, he would have known it was the CIA, not the White House, that was discussing and planning the assassination. Now let's get back to the purpose of the second burglary. Woodward notes Liddy's recounting of the purpose of the second burglary as Magruder slammed his hand on the lower left drawer where Republicans have their oppo dirt on opponents. He does almost accurately do so, but he names O'Brien's desk as the target, whereas Magruder had never used O'Brien's name. And Woodward fails to hook this up with the Maxwell's desk key or the open drawer in the area of Maxwell's desk. Again, he falsely implicates the White House while staying away from the CIA and the girly dirt. Woodward correctly notes that Liddy did not believe that McCord sabotaged the burglary. But Woodward uses peculiar words to say this. So I'll quote Woodward here. Liddy says he does not believe the speculations that James McCord, one of the burglars, was a double agent who knowingly sabotaged the illegal entry. Note that when Woodward uses the term, quote, double agent, unquote, he is likely trying to suggest that Liddy also did not believe that McCord was a CIA agent, a meaning not intended by Liddy, but falsely suggested by Woodward. So let's recap Woodward's analysis of Liddy's book. We have explained how significant were some of Liddy's revelations. The true context of the meeting with Hunt and Gunn and the champagne celebration of the Ellsberg burglars go unmined for rich proof of CIA involvement. John Dean's promises, and indeed his primacy in the break-in program, is missing entirely. McCord's strange behavior on the night of the burglary is omitted. Most meaningful to me, the $30,000 bug ruse would have proven volumes about a secret CIA agenda, again all missing. And as we have shown, Woodward deceptively distorts some of Liddy's revelations to falsely suggest Mitchell's guilt in the burglary operation and supposed White House plans to assassinate Jack Anderson. The only conclusion we can reach is that Woodward is taking advantage of public ignorance, which the Post had earlier cultivated, to cement in collective historical memory a false Watergate narrative. Marks of a guilty criminal mind, according to criminal case jury instructions, are false exculpatory statements and, in another, intentional concealment of evidence. Woodward's review qualifies on both counts as evincing his intentional falsity in his original Watergate reporting. He is, in short, covering up for his guilt with far more intentionality than the semi-clueless Nixon ever evinced. In this review alone, we must render a verdict of guilty as charged. This review should be Exhibit A, or maybe Exhibit B, with the Baker reporting being Exhibit A, of the Post's intentional concealment and distortion of Watergate facts. Baker's report will not go away, nor the reporting done by the Post on it. Nor will the book by Liddy go away, nor Woodward's review of it. Those are set in stone markers of Post dishonesty about Watergate. There is no two ways about it. Thus concludes this episode, A Lid on Liddy. Thank you for listening. I have just completed a book on the same subject entitled The Mysteries of Watergate, What Really Happened. While it covers the material in our podcast, I have added two chapters of contextual materials and removed the repetition needed for a podcast. For those enjoying this series, it will serve as a valuable historical reference. For your non-listening friends, it will prove enlightening and entertaining. Thank you for your support.